Love Osho podcast brings you the real stories of the people whose lives have been inspired and transformed by Osho. We explore why thousands of people are falling in love with Osho and where to find them. Take a deep breath and enjoy the show.
Hello and thanks for tuning in. My name is Swaram and I'm the host. Today our guest is Madeva Premal. Deva took sannyas in 1981 at the age of 11 and went to India to live in the commune with Osho when she was 17. Deva is a classically trained musician and gifted singer, best known for bringing Sanskrit mantras into the mainstream. I'm so happy to have Deva on the show and I hope you enjoy it. Deva, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm so good. Ciao Swaram, come stai?
Lovely, ciao Deva, molto bene. Okay Deva, so to start, tell us a bit about how you came across Osho and how you decided to take sannyas at such young age.
Yeah, I mean, just to put things a little bit into perspective, I guess I have to start a little bit more earlier at my birth, because I was... I came into a family that was a little different to any other German family. And that was a family especially guided by my father, Wolfgang, who was a very strong personality, who was so completely immersed in Eastern spirituality. And like every part of his life would reflect that. And there would be, you know, singing mantras for bedtime stories. I grew up with the Gayatri Mantra as a bedtime song. It would be reciting Zen stories for breakfast, lunch and dinner that we knew by heart. There was a certain Zen story that we all knew by heart. It was like a whole 10-chapter story called The 10 Bulls of Zen. And it would be saying Om when I put something down, or Ram when I switch on the light. Like things like that, just to give a little kind of tapestry of the family that I entered as a... Even though it was in Germany, it just was totally a non-German experience in one way and also very German in another way, because he was very disciplined and he also brought us up in a very disciplined kind of German way. And also that made him very thorough. You know, that's also another quality of the Germans, the very kind of thorough, not serious, but really like giving everything to study and to really experience the depths of things. And that's how he looked at everything. He also studied Christianity. He learned one of the Gospels by heart, and then he illustrated it and wrote it all down, you know, in calligraphy. And like, so he was really not all, but many different paths. He really explored in depth Kabbalah and Zen and yoga and Christianity. And then in 1980, he came across a book by Osho, and he was just saying, wow, now I don't need to read anything else, because it's all in there. Everything that I've been reading, Upanishads and Patanjali and Zen stories and, you know, all Meister Eckhart, and, you know, he was reading Gurdjieff, you know, all these things that I've been studying, reading, they're all contained in the discourses of this man Osho, you know, Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. And wow, what else do we need? We found it in this amazing person that we couldn't meet. I mean, he was in India, we were in Germany. My father also didn't speak English. My mom spoke some English, but also we didn't have really money to travel that far and all that. So it was kind of like this distant wise man that existed and that we had stumbled across. And me being 10, of course, maybe I didn't even know those. I do remember him saying that, like, wow, now there's nothing else I need. In 81, actually still 1980, my mom suddenly was, because he turned his friends on to Osho, as we do, you know, sharing his new treasure with his friends. And one of his friends was a wealthy man who was also one of his employers and also his friend. And he was like, okay, I want to check this out. I want to go to India to the ashram and see what it's like, but I don't know English. And I would really like, you know, my mom, Viten, is her name, to come along as a translator, because she knew English. And there was no question that my father would go, because he didn't like to travel to places where he didn't know the language. And also he was really a very strong personality himself. So he wasn't looking for becoming a disciple of Osho or anything, you know, it was not in his concept. And so that was the kind of the existence way of making it possible or giving my mom the idea that she could actually go to India and have the money to go there. And she was 49 at the time. So, had never, you know, she had traveled quite a lot, but alone to India or to India at all was a big thing. And not knowing anybody except this guy that she was going to translate for. But then in the preparation of this journey, she realized she didn't want to be part of this guy's kind of circle. She didn't really get on with him that well. And she felt like, no, I actually want to go alone. I'm going to do this journey alone. She asked her mom for some money to pay for the flight. And she made her way in January 1981 to Pune. And there's so many beautiful synchronicities. And I don't know if you've already interviewed Turiya for your podcast. Have you?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I have. Yeah. Turiya, beautiful interview. Amazing.
So there's like, for example, my mom had the name Vimalakirti that my father had given to her like 10 years earlier or 20 years earlier before that, when they had met. And, the day my mom arrived in Pune on the 7th of January or whatever, it was the day that Vimalakirti, Turiya's husband, left his body. And so she kind of came straight to this death celebration of Vimalakirti, which was exactly her name. And somehow I felt it was so kind of auspicious that this old life was dying for her in a way too, or was coming to a conclusion, you know, to an end. And she stayed for 7 weeks or something. And I'm saying this because there's so many other parallels with Turiya, like her being from the same little village that my mom comes from and all these. So maybe it makes more sense to me than to you. But anyway, and then she stayed and while she was gone for 6-7 weeks, my dad was taking care of us. My sister and me, who is 3 years older, and it's like January 1981. And he decided, let's just go and check out this Osho center that's an hour drive from where we live and see what it's like. And I still remember so vividly. It was called Purvodaya. It was near Munich. And it was like this farm yard. How do you say, like big farm estate, different houses and barns. And it was all turned into a commune, everybody in red, with a mala around their necks, of course. It was 80s, so people were still very much in the kind of more hippie phase with long beards and long hairs and robes. And just arriving there already felt like totally like, yeah, that's normal. That's it. And I remember sitting there eating and in the communal eating space. None of the people from the commune actually made any contact with us. Like, kind of, it felt like tolerated, but not at all given any attention. And, you know, if somebody says, if anybody would accuse us of wanting to missionarize or get disciples or try to brainwash anybody, it was definitely not the case that anybody even cared if we came or not. You know, there was no, even also not a kind of a polite or, you know, you're new, who are you? It was like, okay, you're now here, you do your thing, I do my thing. If you talk to me, I'll answer, but I'm not going to go out of my way to make you feel especially welcome. And my father said, yeah, you know, they do this because, you know, the ego, you know, that our ego doesn't get stronger, you know. So we already took it all like as a device, as exercise, you know. And then I did my first dynamic meditation there, which was, so I was 10 still, everybody going for it and me too. And I just felt totally, maybe in your podcast, you've already described various times what dynamic meditation looks like. It's a very intense, active meditation with breathing and catharsis and jumping and in a silent stage of 15 minutes of no movement. It's very, very full on, done at 6 a.m. in the morning. And again, I felt totally at ease, normal, at home. It was not like, oh God, where have I landed or what is this? It was just very interesting how it just felt natural. And Osho's face, you know, the photos, it was just so beautiful and attractive and loving. And I couldn't understand the words. I didn't speak any English at the time, so I didn't know what he was saying, but that didn't matter. And so we just kept going there for a few, you know, weekends. And then my mom came back from Pune. She suddenly wore red clothes in Mala, which was a surprise. We didn't know that she had taken sannyas in Pune. Suddenly she came back with a new name, which was Gyan Viten, which is funny because I'm now with Miten. And here she is, Viten with a V, which means beyond knowledge. And she was just totally had found her home as well. Then we start, after she got back, my sister, my mom and me, we started going to the local Osho Center, which was in the same town as ours, Nuremberg, and just doing all meditations every weekend, Saturday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, all evening we would meditate there and find our little community of friends there and just all felt very natural. And pretty soon I said, oh, I want to become a sannyasin as well. And they said, yeah, be welcome. But I mean, it means, you know, wearing red clothes and wearing a mala around your neck with Osho's picture. Are you ready for that? And actually, I talked more with people. And then somebody said, oh, you know what? Some people just don't do it at work or at school. And that's okay. You know, you just, like at school, you just don't do it. You just go normal clothes. And then when you come home, you put on your red clothes. So with that idea, I sent off the letter to Pune with my picture and the signature of my parents. My father also was okay for me to do that. And it took a long time to get that letter, to get the name. I think it took 6-7 weeks or something. And that was in May 18th, I received the name. So it was like April, May. I was waiting for the name. And I felt, this is so not right, you know, if either you do it or you don't, like either you go to school with red and mala or you just don't even do it at all, because that's the point, that you are out there seen like this, you know, that you put yourself into that challenge of being different or having to explain or whatever that means. And I, you know, the thing is that I was so fed up of being different actually at that point, because I'd been different all my life. And now I was again like going to be like completely different, like even more obviously different. I've been a vegetarian all my life, and you know, our house looked so different. My father was so different. So all these things. And now I was going to even more emphasize that kind of different path I was on, you know, compared to my classmates. But anyway, I did do it. I went to school with red clothes and mala for about 7 years, actually 2 years longer than Osho, after in 85, he said, it's no more needed. You don't need the red clothes anymore. And I still kept going for another 2 years because I just loved it so much. And it just felt natural. I never got any bad vibes from anybody. And then I realized also that the kids, my classmates, they were more shy than me. They didn't ask me what it was, you know, they were a little bit like, maybe they talked behind my back, I don't know, but they took a few years before somebody came and said, like, what is it actually you're doing there? So it's now 81, 82, and then 83, Osho was in America. It was obvious I couldn't see him in India anymore. And now I'm 13, and he's on the ranch in Oregon. The first festival is being advertised, and it is exactly in the time when it is. Still school and no holidays, and my mom got like special holidays from Osho for me to go to, not from Osho, from the school director, for me to go to the festival. Like I was legally, I could go on religious holiday and legally, you know, not go to school for 2 weeks or so. That was incredible. Also beautiful support, you know, from my normal school system. And that was the first time that I met Osho and saw Osho, because I never met him personally. But I sat in satsang for the first time with 15,000 people getting in line at 5 a.m. so I could sit quite as much in front as possible. And I was just in tears when I saw him for the first time. It was such a beautiful, strong moment, of course. And being there and being in this like sea of people that you knew that whoever you talk to, it would be fine. You're pretty much on the same page. You could, you know, share a hug with pretty much anybody that you saw if you wanted to. And it would be a natural thing and it wouldn't be, mean anything sexually or whatever. It was just, we would be like, I mean, I was 13 anyway, I was young, but anyway, that it was just a family, you know, that I was safe, that I could be alone in there and nobody would bother me. I could be, you know, late in the night, I could walk around and it would be safe. It was just such a beautiful feeling to be in this environment of everybody is in a peaceful, loving space. And there for the same reason, you know, like to grow, to be near Osho, to be in that field of his guidance, which transforms and challenges and wakes us up. I mean, I only stayed there 10 days or 2 weeks at that point. I went another time a year later for 3 weeks, where I really joined the commune life and worked 16 hours a day on the truck farm, doing the seedlings and the greenhouse, which I loved. You know, I felt so free and so really beautiful to get on the bus at 6 a.m. with the 30 other people going also to the truck farm, singing in the bus and working all day, which really didn't feel like work, and getting back home in the evening. And yeah, it was just just natural, just being at home. And then when I was 17, because sometimes people wonder, like, you know, I didn't live in a commune or anything between 11 and 17. I went to school basically just like everybody else in Germany, and did the weekly meditations in the weekends at the Osho Center, and that was basically my life. And at 17, Osho came back to Pune, India, and that's when I went for the first time to India, and was in his presence in India for the first time, which is, of course, a completely different feeling. Also much smaller, you know, not the 15,000 people in Oregon that were around him when we could see him, but here we are with 1,000 or 2,000 or whatever many sitting every day. At this point, of course, I can understand English, and I'm 17, and I'm like, wow, what an amazing life. I get to go to India at 17 and be in an ashram and stayed there for a few weeks, came back to school, went again in 1988 for a few weeks to India, to Pune again in the summer holidays, and with my mom, because she was a school teacher, so she had the same holidays as me. And I kept saying to her, oh, just really don't want to go back, you know, I don't want to go back to school. And I had only one more year to complete in school. And I kept saying that to her, but not really, you know, meaning it. I thought, you know, of course I go back. Of course you need to finish what you started and all that. But she was amazing. She's such an amazing, benevolent spirit. And she would have liked to have stayed there. So she wanted to make it possible for me to stay there. She would have done anything for that. And one day before we were meant to fly back together, she said, you can stay if you want. I'll pay for you to stay. And you have 24 hours to decide, because if you know, we need to know about your flight and all that. And I decided to stay. So she leaves and I'm like left in India on my own. I mean, I'm in the system of the ashram, or in the cradle of the ashram, but on the other hand, everybody lives outside the ashram, rents their own apartments or flats. So you have your own life. And then in the day you come to work or do therapies or meditate in the ashram. And, so I stayed, and, that was a difficult time, that when she first left and I had made the decision not to go back to school, which was only one more year. And school had been so easy for me. So it wasn't like a kind of traumatic thing that I was escaping. It was actually a breeze to go get through school. And here I was, one of those dropouts that I never wanted to be. And I wanted to, you know, because I'd had a judgment about people who don't finish their education and who are just kind of, you know, a little bit too flaky. But it also didn't feel right to go back. So anyway, I was pretty shook up those first weeks, 2-3 weeks after she left. And then I actually wrote to Osho and I said, what should I do? You know, like explaining my situation. And I was so touched that somebody actually called me in the office and said, Osho wants to know more about your situation to give you an answer. And I was so touched that he would take that much care of somebody little like me, you know, insignificant. And more of an insignificant subject that I was asking. And then the answer came back and Osho said, yeah, it's good if you go back and finish your school. And you can always come in the holidays, but do go back. It didn't really come as a surprise because you always encourage people to finish their education. But still I needed to hear it from him. And I also, when I heard it, it was like, of course, that's also what I really feel to do. Really, that feels right. And then the school had already, was already so far gone that there was no point in rushing back. And so I stayed a whole year and decided to just miss a year in school and then pick it up again when I got back. And so I had a fantastic year in the ashram, being free, being, 18 alone without parents anymore and just diving into the community, into the magic life of ashram life where things happen in synchronicity that you don't expect. You know, people you meet or don't meet, even on that small area. When do you meet somebody? What happens? What talks happen? What, I had a love affair with a Japanese man that I really loved and lasted for a few months and it was really deep and things like that, very magical life, very in the music, just dancing every day in the Buddha hall with everybody that I just loved so much, where we could just sing and dance and just without any social thing around it, without talking, just this white marble floor, empty, huge space where we could just really let go into dancing and singing. And then I went back then it was time to go back to finish the school for a year. And that was exactly the year that Osho left his body. So I was actually not there at that point, which was very sad, but that was apparently meant to be. That was a hard year, feeling only like missing the ashram so much and my friends there and now being back at school in this system, in this German system. But anyway, there was no doubt that I would finish it. And I just had to get through those, 8 months. But that was also a very key experience for me that I realized I was waiting for those 8 months to finish and that I wanted to not live like that ever again, that I wanted anything to finish, that I wanted to have a life which would really, every moment would be enjoyed and loved more or less. These were 8 months where I was counting the days for it to be finished. So it was a long stretch of not wanting to be in that moment. And I didn't want to live like that again. And I finished school and then went straight as quickly as possible to Pune back. And my mom again was ready to pay for me to be there. So I was there another 2 years. And that's when I met Miten pretty quickly after. So is that the answer to your question?
Yes, indeed. Absolutely. Well, beautiful. Thank you for giving us a full-on story of how you came across Osho and your time with him and your interaction. And I never knew about that. I did some research before the interview and I read lots of articles and interviews, but didn't find this that you just said. Thank you. So, you came to Osho very early in your life. And perhaps the question would be, how meeting Osho and living in the commune changed your life? Or you could also say, have you ever thought of a life without Osho?
No, because being 10, 11, when I entered the world of Osho, of course, I can't imagine anything else because it's my life for the last almost 40 years now. So it also didn't really change my life as much as that it was just, sudden, like everybody changes in their teenage years in some way. And that was what I grew into, it felt like a natural growing into. It wasn't like, oh yeah, my life is completely different now. Also because I grew up with meditation and also the concept of reincarnation and of guru and somehow all that was actually already part of my, worldview. It wasn't like completely 180 degree turn. So I can't say that Osho changed my life. I can really just say that he that being in his field and through his guiding light and in his presence, my life has blossomed in the most beautiful way.
What would you say is the most important lesson that you learned from Osho that is helping you in your life today?
I always wonder, like, what is Osho's teaching? You know, how could we say what Osho's teaching is? And I feel the living in the moment with a feeling of gratitude, of an understanding that everything is divine, and to live that as totally as possible. I feel that's Osho's teaching in a nutshell, and that's with me all the time. I feel that's how I live all the time. Yeah, that's pretty much the biggest guiding light that he has given me, to focus the light on the moment and be in there and be comfortable in the moment and be present in the moment. It's an ongoing practice, because I space out and I go out of the moment. But that's my learning this lifetime.
Wonderful. And do you feel any difference in these teachings of Osho, or better to say, do you feel any difference in the way you apply this understanding from Osho when he was in the body and when you were younger compared to today?
I mean, just not that much, because I was never physically close to him. So in that way, it didn't change so much. Although there was things that he changed so he left his body when I was 20. So the first 10 years of being with him, there was always this sense that he could change things and they would change what we would go through. Like, he would change, oh, don't wear red and mala anymore. See what it's like to be in the world in a more invisible way. Or he would change his name, or he would change how we would be in the ashram with the maroon robes and the white robes and all that. So we would go through these changes, and that was a beautiful feeling to be guided by a living guru who would surprise you and who would challenge you. And obviously since then, nothing has in a way changed. Everything has now become pretty much almost like a ritual. Also just the way he left things in the end with the evening meditation. I think it's still being done that way now. And for us, we stayed another 10 years in the ashram after he left his body. Until 1999, we were there the last time, Miten and I, spending, 4 to 6 months every winter there. And then we felt like actually now the walls of the ashram have dissolved for us, and we find that space everywhere, and we actually create it everywhere. And if I'm honest, I feel what we do in our events and concerts actually, and also holiday retreats and everywhere, that's the space I experienced in Pune, and that's what I loved about Pune and being in the ashram. And I don't know if that still exists in the ashram. I'm sure it does. I just haven't been there for so long. But we create it now wherever we go. And it doesn't have to even have a name of Osho or, that whole, it's a feeling of celebration. It's a feeling of celebrating everything, of being connected, of loving, of being aware, of being in community. All those things that I loved about the ashram, we've now created traveling all over the world.
Indeed, what you and Miten do is incredible, and you touch so many people. So we can't do this interview without touching upon the mantras, chanting the mantras.
Yeah.
So when you sing mantras, you channel the energy and vibration attached to those ancient mantras. But at the same time, you are connected to Osho's energy. So I'm curious to know if you have any particular feeling or sensation or smell or anything like that that tells you that Osho's energy is there for you.
I don't know. I'm kind of quite a simple person, and I can't really distinguish all these things minutely. For me, it's just a feeling of joy, and I don't give it any name. I don't know if it's the ancient mantras, or if it's Osho, or if it's existence, or if it's God or the divine. It doesn't really matter for me what it's called. Actually, it's a joyful moment. It's actually a very simple, ecstatic and very simple feeling. Yeah, I couldn't really give it any name, and I wouldn't really want to distinguish, because I don't feel there is any difference, you know, when we are connected to a divine space. Otherwise, it wouldn't be that space, you know, because that space is so big. It includes everything.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So the next question is from my beloved Chetna. I guess it's a more feminine touch to it. If you were to sing a mantra for Osho today, what would that be?
Oh, it would be the Gayatri mantra, of course. Of course. That would be amazing. I mean, I didn't start singing when Osho was in his body, so I never sang for him in the body. Miten, of course, did a lot. But for me, like that very delicate space when people are sitting in silence with their eyes closed, and either it's in a concert hall or it's in a group room, or it's right now it's maybe online because we're doing these daily online meditations. That sound that we put in there is always that sound that is for Osho, you know, that very, very delicate sound to put into a silence that is so receptive and that is also vulnerable. You know, people are in a vulnerable space when they come meditate. And what are you going to put into the field? What sound are you going to put in there? And that's the sound that's the feeling I have when I sing. There, it's like Osho being there, you know? It's the same feeling, like this precious being of Osho, this very sensitive, amazing being of Osho. What sound would I want to offer to this precious being? And that's the same as everybody who comes to sing with us. So it's very delicate. And the Gayatri mantra is the most precious and the most me, you know, the most at home for me. So that's what I would offer for sure.
Talking a little bit about the Osho Sangha today, as we mentioned before, you and Miten, you guys, you bring Osho's energy around the world and you travel to a lot of places and you do events, concerts and holiday retreats. So where do you feel Osho's energy is more alive and kicking today, if you like? What are the places where you feel like juicy?
I mean, the edges are so blurred now because obviously you don't even know who's been touched by Osho. And, but you know, I mean, of course, Corfu, you know, now everything is so different, but we usually spend 2 months a year in Corfu in Greece. And there we sometimes call it Puna 3, or, you know, because there's so many, Osho sannyasins coming to spend the summer or those weeks there. There were also centers that were opened there already 20, 30 years ago that were opened by Osho sannyasins, Alexis Sorbas with Anadi and Pari. And so there's a big, strong Osho root in that place, Corfu. And I feel, but then, you know, when we're there, who cares who is an Osho sannyasin and who isn't? But there's definitely the flavor there, which I've been talking about, that flavor of community. And then also Byron Bay, you know, we spend 3-4 months a year in Byron Bay. We also used to call that Puna 3 or Puna 4 because so many people who used to go to Puna to spend the winters there then moved on to Australia, which is what happened to us. We've been there for the last 20 years every summer of their summer. I feel strongly there too. But, you know, actually, we used to spend a lot of time in Italy and we used to spend a lot of time in Miasto and actually live there also, close to Miasto. So I know that's a thriving community and, but we haven't been there for so long and it just hasn't happened. But I know that's a beautiful Osho place, or Osho Uta in Cologne, you know, and that's a thriving Osho community that is for there for the last 20, 30 years. So there are some pockets left, but as far as communes go, there are not many. Eh? But there are some pockets where there's more, a higher concentration of people who were touched or who are touched or who live with Osho as their master.
And I understand that now you are in Costa Rica and probably mm-hmm. you are stuck there because of the coronavirus, but I hear that you conduct holiday retreats. And I hear a lot of people talking about Costa Rica as a place that is awakening spiritually and consciously. So what about Costa Rica?
Oh, Costa Rica is beautiful. I mean, we don't really feel like we're stuck here, but we are just really very, very happy that we were very happy that we were here when everything changed and that we could stay. Costa Rica, I mean, in terms of Osho, I don't know, there's a Pachamama is very close to here, which is run by Tioja, who is a spiritual teacher who comes from the Osho lineage. He's an Osho's disciple, and he created this commune around his own teachings and his guidance. So that's very close to, but I'm not so connected there. Don't go there so much because I don't go anywhere really. But as a country, you know, Costa Rica is just has this beautiful sweetness. You know, they don't have an army. Everybody always tells you that about Costa Rica, that they put their money in education instead of army. Then they do a lot more ecological conscious projects. And yeah, I think Costa Rica is beautiful. I don't know if it's especially an Osho place as such. But like I say, it's more of a flavor now. It's not anymore. We don't need to call it that so much anymore, I don't feel.
I spoke to Abby just recently. I had an interview with...
Oh, yes. Yeah.
He said that you do some kind of holiday retreats in Costa Rica
too. Yes, we do for many years, yeah. And that's why we were here. That's why we happened to be here. So, yeah, we do that every year and we love it. Been doing it for many years.
Wonderful. So, of course, now with the COVID situation, everyone is a bit on hold. The whole world is on hold, even though things are slowly coming back to normal, hopefully. What are your latest projects? Is there anything in the pipeline, anything new exciting coming up?
Yeah, we're so, so busy. One thing is that we've been doing these daily online meditations for the last 60-something days. And that's been a big part of our lives, obviously. You know, it's at 2 p.m. for us every day. And it's a big event that happens every day for us where we sit on our little bench and, sing and chant the Om mantra and Gayatri mantra. And in many, actually, we've been really reconnecting and sharing many of the Osho songs that we used to sing in the ashram. And so there's a lot of songs that also people haven't heard from that time and that get a lot of, people are loving them, you know, they're really enjoying hearing all our soundtrack. That's been a big part. And I don't know how long we keep going with that. We don't know yet, but we will see how it all unfolds. And then we've been, you know, doing some recording, actually not recording, but putting together some music that we will put out soon, which is one project. This is very sweet. It's actually a instrumental album of my last album called Deva. So it's basically the everything except my voice from that album. And it's such a beautiful space in the room because, there's such beautiful instrumentation and arrangements. And just to have that flavor in the room without any voice or mantra, it's actually really beautiful. So we've been working on putting that together and Miten's making a kind of a Deva kind of retrospective. In 1998 to 2020, 22 years of Deva Premal music, what the best of. So he's really immersed in that. So things like that. And then there's so much online, you know, so many online, like with you now and festivals. And, you know, it's actually a very busy time here, yeah, although nothing happens, but we're very busy.
That's a paradox.
Yeah.
So, Deva, we are heading towards the end and I have three final questions I ask all the guests on the show. But before that, is there anything else that you would like to add about you and Osho, something that perhaps we didn't cover or didn't ask?
Yes, I just really want to, for the Akashic Records and for Osho to hear and just my hugest gratitude for meeting Miten in Osho's ashram. I mean, that's the biggest, hugest gift I received from Osho is that I was led to meet this, you know, man from England, quite a lot older than me, you know, very different background. How would we have ever met otherwise? And to have had Osho's guidance on how to live in relationship and how to honor and respect each other and encourage and challenge each other. And just without Osho's guiding light, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be living this life together like this. And this is such a huge, I mean, I can't even, I can't even say it in words. It's like I just bow down in full gratitude for that and will be forever grateful.
Wow, that is very sweet, very beautiful and very sincere. So thank you for sharing it with us. Okay, so the last questions. What's your favorite meditation and why?
Osho meditation?
Yes, yes.
Yes, I love Osho Kundalini meditation. I love shaking, I love the dancing. I love the way it makes me feel. It's just such a simple and straight to the point meditation that never fails to make me feel so deep and peaceful and complete.
The last question is, you live the Osho experiment. What does it mean to you personally to be with Osho today in 2020?
I think I've talked about that. I think it's pretty much, I've pretty much said it. Basically, what I'm living is that, you know, living in harmony as much as possible with nature, with community, in respect, with eyes wide open and a heart full of compassion and love and the realization that this too will pass and nothing is really that serious. I think that's pretty much it.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Deva. It's been a real pleasure connecting with you. And I really thank you for your time, for being part of the Osho podcast. And I wish you all the best in Costa Rica. And it looks like you are having good time there anyway, regardless of the situation with the COVID. But I also wish you, go back on doing the things that you guys love doing, traveling the world, sharing your beautiful energy, Osho's energy and the mantra. And doing all the beautiful things that you normally do.
Thank you. Thank you, Swaram.
Thank you, Deva. Lots of love. Bye-bye.
Lots of love to you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it and leave a review. Visit loveosho.com for more episodes, blogs, or to connect with us.